Why has she no self-awareness, people ask about Liz Truss? A period of discretion, surely. Can she really still be blaming the Reds at the Bank of England? As zombie Trussonomics lumbers on, we ask, was it ever alive? Is it really dead? And is it more dangerous than it looks?
I face the most almighty backlash for those conservative policies that I tried to put in place. From the usual suspects in the media, from the usual suspects in the corporate world, but also from people that were meant to work for the government.
Because the fact is, the left have succeeded in infiltrating our campuses, infiltrating our schools, our corporations. So it's not enough just to take the White House. It's not enough just to take the Senate. You've actually got to change a hell of a lot of what's going on in our countries. And we've got the same problem in Britain.
Welcome to another Europe podcast with me, Zoe Williams, and my co-host, Luke Cooper. Our guest on today's podcast is David Runciman, Professor of Politics at Cambridge and host of the podcast Past, Present, Future. David recently wrote a fascinating article in The Guardian, which we'll link to in the show notes, in which he asked this question: why hasn't Liz Truss gone away? We'll be talking about what it means for British politics and the reconfiguration of the Conservative Party and the right more generally after the general election. Also, what it means for the right across the OECD. Is it as well networked, resourced and energetic as it sometimes looks? Why is the normal socio-political inoculation against that magical thinking and extreme self-belief not working as it once would have?
Hi, this is Seema. I joined Another Europe is Possible in 2018. For me, the most important thing about this space is building a transnational movement for a more democratic economy, anti-racist politics, and global solidarity beyond nationalism. So that's why I hope you join the Another Europe is Possible family too. Go to anothereurope.org/join and sign up to get access to an extended version of this podcast.
Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi, Zoe. Hi, Luke.
Congrats on the new podcast, David. How's it going?
Yeah, good, thanks. It's about the history of ideas, so it's a slightly harder sell than the one I used to do, which was kind of about the craziness of Brexit. But yeah, it's good.
I loved the history of ideas. Would you call that the kind of... You did have a history of ideas podcast attached to Talking Politics previously.
Yeah, so that was an offshoot of COVID when universities were shut down. And I thought I'd do my lectures online as a podcast. It turns out people like them. So yeah, there's quite a lot more of that as well. Me talking about, you know, ideas and books and stuff. But also we've just done a series about historical American elections and what they mean for now. We've done a series with Leah Ippi about the history of freedom. So there's a lot going on.
Fantastic. So can't wait to get stuck into that. So you've recently written for The Guardian about the rise and fall, and can we call it rise again?
I hope not.
Of Liz Truss. Well, we'll talk about it. But let's go back to that time of the fall of Liz Truss, her time in office. What was that like lasting vandalism to British politics, and how long will it take British politics to recover from the short-lived, historically short-lived Liz Truss era?
I mean, the economic damage was definitely real. You know, I'm not an economist, but you don't have to be an economist, right? I think the members of the British public twigged it straight away. Interest rates went up, the pound collapsed, mortgage rates went up. They stayed up for a while. I think some of that has come out in the wash. I mean, it's a little like Black Wednesday, you know, if you remember back in the day, there was an immediate shock of it. But then some of those effects fade quite quickly. Money got tighter. You know, it's the British economy is definitely not in better shape because Liz Truss was prime minister for 49 days. I mean, the lasting damage is to the Conservative Party. You know, that's going to take, I don't know, a decade or more to get over. I mean, she trashed the brand and she definitely did damage to British politics. I mean, the thing that I think about now when I think about her prime ministership, she and Kwasi Kwarteng had an emergency budget, which was a disaster. It wasn't properly thought through. They hadn't thought through how the markets would react. They came across as reckless and incompetent. But it wasn't like she was good at any of the other bits either. She didn't seem to be qualified to be prime minister. I thought it at the time before she was elected. She was terrible in the debates. I don't know if you remember the debates for the leadership. She was awful. When she was prime minister, She was awful in the Commons. She was dreadful in press conferences. She was like a rabbit in the headlights. She was awful at the Queen's funeral. She was a terrible Prime Minister. And one of the questions that I think a lot of people had after that was, how did it happen? You know, it's not like the Conservative Party is a sort of suicidal death cult. I don't think it is. But it chose someone who, I think, not just with hindsight, clearly wasn't up to it to be Prime Minister. And that does shake people's confidence in politics. You know, if you put someone like that in charge of a country, even if it's for a very brief period, and even if the system sort of spits them out when they screw up, it still makes you sort of sit back and think, this system doesn't really work.
But I mean, I'm thinking back to what to a brilliant piece you wrote about Theresa May and the parliamentary system, which basically pointed out the realities of how Parliament worked, and from there, why the anti-Brexit movement was never going to get off the ground. We don't really have time to do Brexit again. But how much of Liz Truss's election as leader was basically just because that's the way the cookie crumbled, you know? That was, by the time you get through all the other candidates and down to the Conservative membership, and by the time the party is riven, there isn't any meaningful route to choosing somebody based on their qualities. You just have to choose whoever, I don't want to call it the gerontocracy, but the gerontocracy of the Tory party decides.
Yeah, it's a weird system. I still think when Theresa May became Prime Minister, you didn't think, well, the Conservative Party's lost its mind. I mean, it was, you can take a view of her one way or the other, but it wasn't, she wasn't implausible.
No.
And, you know, Liz Truss feels to me like a kind of different phenomenon. And she did clearly appeal to that tiny electorate, the membership of the Conservative Party. She was up against Rishi Sunak. They chose her over him. You know, weirdly, even though she was a Remainer and he was a Brexiteer, you know, there was, as many people pointed out, it was a classic kind of vibes contest rather than who these people actually were and what they had once stood for. She felt Brexity, and she also felt like, I think, to that membership, like a sort of truth teller, like someone who, and you know, she does have a quality which is, there's something a bit odd about her. You're never quite sure what she's going to say. And I think for a lot of people, it's a bit like Trump, actually. There's an appeal in the thought that she, you know, she might say what they're thinking. But my God, that's not a qualification to be Prime Minister. And that election still feels to me like a weird one, in that the choice was so narrow and she was so ill-qualified for the job that she was selected for. And the parliamentary party, I think, knew it. I mean, they got rid of her so quickly that you have to suspect that many of them thought that this was bound to happen. Whereas with Theresa May, it was like 3 years of drawn out agony as they tried to get rid of her, because many of them still believed in her. But with Liz Truss, you know, the second that, you know, people could see the emperor had no clothes, that was it. So it was a unique premiership in British history. It was, there's never been anything like it.
And that's what I like about your analysis, David, is that it draws attention to the baffling quality of this in some ways, because you mentioned at the beginning the exchange rate mechanism crisis of 1992, and you can go back now and see it as a kind of flawed moment in the political economy of British statecraft, if you like. The government got something badly wrong, but it was within a kind of context where we can understand the decision making as rational in the context of what they were trying to achieve. It kind of made sense in its own terms that they had this idea that the UK was a strong economy, that it shouldn't be undervalued in relation to Germany, and it would enter the exchange rate mechanism at a higher rate that reflected that standing in the global economic order. Now, that fell foul of the financial forces that, ironically, the British government had unleashed or contributed to the unleashing of over the previous 20 years and particularly the previous decade. But nonetheless, it made sense. And similarly, as you emphasise with Theresa May, clearly she made sense as a political figure and a politician that was setting out to achieve a Brexit that she saw as credible and a kind of compromise with the Brexit voting electorate, and particularly its most hardline anti-immigration sentiments, and the economic interests of the UK as a whole, to try and find a compromise between those two different elements. And Liz Truss comes in and completely shakes that system in this rather fantastical way. I mean, I've heard it described. I think James Meadway actually talked about this at the time as it was unfolding. It was a kind of experiment in far-right modern monetary theory, if you like, that macroeconomic policy can be dumped, that we shouldn't really have to, you know, give much concern to balanced budgets, and we have these huge tax cuts, and it was always kind of appeared doomed to fail. We've gone from that baffling moment in political economy to Liz Truss's subsequent developments. How would you describe the link between what she's trying to do today and what she did then?
Yeah, so she has an explanation. She's got a book. I went to hear her talk about it. She says the same thing over and over again. You know, her view is that what looked to the rest of the world like a kind of crazy, reckless experiment in monetary policy, she thinks was rational and sane. But what was wrong with it? You know, she's admitted that she thinks she went a bit quickly. And then she thinks that she was sabotaged by these institutions that she, you know, I've heard her say it. And when she says it, it does take your breath away. The word she uses is that they have been infiltrated with communists, these communist institutions, the Bank of England, the OBR, and so on. And that the thought is, if she'd gone a bit slower and if they had been more supportive, the markets wouldn't have taken fright. And I think there are two things you could say about that, one of which is I don't think that's true. But the second is, it's as though those things are trivial. She said, when I heard her speak, she says, she speaks this language, she says it's, you know, it's not enough just to will the ends, you have to will the means. And the mistake that conservatives like her have made is they haven't thought enough, hard enough about the means. They just, there are these things they want to do, but they haven't thought about how they're going to achieve them. And then she says, you know, these institutions were against me and they've been infiltrated by lefties who are always going to sabotage me. And so that, you know, it's sort of not my fault. As though somehow this fact is incidental to what she wanted to do. You know, these are the institutions of the British state. So whatever you believe about them, you know, you can believe that they're full of communists, or you can believe they're full of sensible, reasonably well-educated people who are trying to support the government of the day. And the second is more likely to be true than the first. But whatever it is, you know, you have to bring on side, this is politics, you have to bring on side the people through whom you're going to enact your policies. You have to decide what is a sensible time frame. So it's almost as though she's saying, despite my new mantra, which is we have to will the means and the ends, actually, because the ends were the right ends, the fact that the means didn't work doesn't reflect badly on the ends. It's kind of insane. But I think she believes it. The other thing about her, it's hard to judge people just from sort of hearing them speak, even in the flesh. But she seems like, either because she knows there's no other way she can appear in public, or because she genuinely has this conviction, she has persuaded herself of this story. She has persuaded herself that what she wanted to do did make sense, and she was undermined by some sort of tactical errors on her part, timing, and by a deep state conspiracy against her. When you hear her say it, you can't believe that there are many other people who are going to believe it. There is a small coterie of people who clearly do believe it, and some of them are still in the Conservative Party. Quite a few of them are outside the Conservative Party in Reform and in other places. And then there are quite a few people in think tanks who seem to believe that. But the one thing it doesn't sound like is the kind of thing on which anyone in a million years is ever going to win an election.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I worried about when I was looking at PopCon, the conference that you describe, is that it didn't seem to care that people found it ridiculous. Mm. And maybe that was part of the play, right? They're not talking to mainstream politics, and they're not talking to the mainstream commentariat. So who are they talking to?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I'd never been really to an event like that before. And it was fascinating. It was an odd crowd. So it was, you know, failed Tory politicians, Jacob Rees-Mogg, people who were Tory politicians then and about 20 minutes later weren't, like Lee Anderson. It was a think tank world, sort of Tufton Street think tank world. Nigel Farage was there. But they didn't feel like they were just talking to themselves. You know, they have a sense that there is an audience for this. So one possibility is that it's an international audience. And actually what they're doing is trying to connect to what they think is a movement that exists outside of the UK. What was really striking at this event is they all completely accepted the Labour Party was going to form the next government, and they kind of didn't care. I mean, it's almost like this was This wasn't the issue for them. That's incidental to the big story, which is this grand narrative about the decline of the West and the ways in which the lefties have taken over all of the leading institutions. And so election results come and go. And yet these people were also clearly still incredibly bitter about what had happened to Boris Johnson. They were still arguing that the Conservative Party keeps winning elections but doesn't somehow enact the platform on which it's elected. And then the thing, no question, the thing that gives them a weird hidden confidence is their feeling that Britain is an outlier. So a few of them were saying, either explicitly or implicitly, sure, Keir Starmer's going to win, but just look at the wider world. I mean, Keir Starmer winning in this country is not the trend. It is not the direction of travel. They didn't mention Trump, but clearly many of them hope Trump will win. But they're particularly looking at Europe. And in Europe, they think their version of the right is on the march. In Italy, in France, in Germany, going to be in the EU parliamentary elections. And I think what gives them hope is the thought that Britain's about to elect a Labour government, which is going to be exposed internationally. And when it falls apart, and I'm sure they're convinced it will fall apart, then Britain will join the populist tide. And I think that's what gives them hope. And actually, on that, I'm not sure they are necessarily wrong.
There's, on the international audience question, I suppose there's two ways to think about this. One is there's a kind of network of ideas that Liz Truss has put herself at the centre of that does, to a large degree, emanate from the United States. But then there's also this network of money. And I just feel that the network of ideas is probably the more important factor. I mean, listeners may have seen, and, you know, this stunning interview that Liz Truss gives when she's launching the book in the United States, where she's sitting there with Steve Bannon, nodding along as he says ever more insane, frankly, and fascist things, including backing Tommy Robinson at one point. And she just replies, yes, I think that's absolutely right, Steve, on several occasions.
The grooming situation?
Yes.
Hang on, I don't understand this. The grooming situation, Tommy Robinson, all these heroes fought it. The rape situation. And in that community, you're going to have a special election and you may have a radical jihadist party send somebody to commons
after all that problems. That is correct.
And it's easy to laugh at this in part because of the kind of choreography and style of the interview. I don't know if this is the right analogy, but I had the feeling it was like a 1980s American talk show where the Muppets were being, you know, paraded, or an episode of Sesame Street or something. There's something quite weird about how it's choreographed and the whole style of it. But this is a British Prime Minister that has gone over to the United States and basically endorsed the ideas of a fascist and sees it as strategically helpful to her campaign to restore her position in Europe. And I was just wondering what you think about that, and is it a follow the money question or is it a follow the ideas question?
Yeah, it is interesting. And some of the things that she has done, particularly in promoting the book, and it's bizarre what people will do to promote books. You know, I don't know what arrangement she has with her publishers. And she's so proud that it got into the Sunday Times bestseller list. I think it got in at number 7. You didn't have to sell that many books in hardback. But, you know, best-selling author Liz Truss, touring the world, promoting her book. But I don't think she is at the center of those ideas. You know, she's an object of fascination in the UK. Outside of the UK, she's a joke, or, you know, she's quite an obscure figure. After all, she wasn't prime minister for long. I don't think she was prime minister long enough to register in America's political consciousness. And on some of these platforms, you see her and you see that actually the people she's speaking with don't have much idea who she really is. So there is something a bit odd about it, that she's using these overseas trips, particularly in the United States, to sort of raise her profile among people with whom I don't think she's ever going to have much of a profile, in order somehow to reestablish herself as a significant figure back here. It feels a little unhinged to me. There's clearly something desperate about it, but the ideas do chime. And I don't think she herself knows or has thought really hard about where the limits of her worldview is. She's so desperate for a new kind of respectability, that is, you know, no longer to be a joke, that she will nod along to anything, but she can't. You know, if you think she was a Liberal Democrat, she was a Remainer. When she was in government, she was by all accounts a very eccentric, very poorly briefed minister. That is, she never read her briefs. She often would say bizarre things. Her civil servants never quite knew what she was up to. But she was malleable, and she usually ended up promoting or enacting the government's policy of the day. And this was Cameron government and then Theresa May government. You know, these weren't fascist governments. So there is something very odd and eccentric about the way in which she's been willing just to ban the limits of what she thinks is acceptable in the cause of promoting a book. On the question of the money, I'm just not sure. It is a really interesting question whether this is going both ways. You know, we've sent them Liz Truss and they're sending us, the Americans, kind of far-right funding into think tanks, which is now entered into the British body politic or entered into the sort of bloodstream of British public discourse. When you're in the room with these people, so when I was there at the launch of PopCon, it didn't feel like you were present at something that was at the tip of some big, well-funded operation. It's shambolic. It's incompetent. You know, the sort of leaflets that they produced hadn't even been properly proofread. They were illiterate. The guy who was introducing it, Mark Littlewood, who used to be head of the IEA, didn't even know the name of the organization he was promoting. He kept calling it popular conservatism. And everyone in the room noticed this, you know, like the conservatives in the room noticed that it's not the same as conservatism. So it's this weird thing. And then in the room are all of the think tank people from, you know, the Tufton Street right libertarian think tanks and their children. So it reminded me of that scene in Armando Iannucci's film In the Loop, which is my favorite ever political film, where the sort of Alistair Campbell figure goes to Washington to meet the, you know, the powers that be, and he's taken into rooms where literally children are in charge, the far right. The apparatchiks of these sinister far right people are 18-year-old boys wearing tweed jackets and weirdly colored ties. And it had that vibe to it. So it's sort of hard to take it seriously as the front of this, you know, big money operation that's coming to infiltrate British politics. And yet, having said all of that, I am aware there is money behind this. You know, there are people, well-funded people, an international network of well-funded people who would very much like to promote these ideas in the UK and anywhere where there's an audience for them. And no doubt they feel, you know, in Liz Truss, whatever you think about her, she was prime minister. It's not like she's nobody. And they have got a willing spokesperson for this. So I'm sort of conflicted on this. Having seen them in action, I want to feel it's kind of a joke, but I'm aware that would be complacent.
The thing which makes me worry about the funding is not that they look incredibly slick, but that there's the cross-pollination and the coherence and the singing from the same hymn sheet is very pronounced with this lot. You know, it's like one of them decides that this week is the week to go on about unisex toilets, and then they're all at it. And I just worry that the progressive side will never be able to coordinate as well. And I don't know whether that's from being funded or just being better at sticking to the script or whether coordination is necessary. I'm just really kind of stumbling around with this.
Yeah, and to go back to what I said before, so if you have to try and think, what is the wider strategy here? So when you hear them lay out their position, you know, some of it is ridiculous. You know, they, literally at this event, one of the speakers was talking about how the Keir Starmer government was going to put a tax on biscuits because biscuits make people fat. And that is a basic right of an English man. I think they always talked in that language. To buy, I quote, two packets of biscuits and not pay a tax on the second packet. And you think, well, that, you know, if that's coordination, good luck to them. And yet, the thing that really, I think, is worth focusing on, if they were asked what is the 5-year or 10-year strategy, is a lot of this is about climate policies and net zero. And what they see is a coming wave of, you know, government regulation and bureaucracy and sort of quangocracy politics around net zero. And bits of politics in the UK would give them reason to think that it's not that hard to foment a quite strong popular electoral reaction against that. You know, the ULEZ by-election, when Boris Johnson's seat was held by the Tories, I know people argue about what really happened there. You know, there was a panic that Sadiq Khan was going to lose. He didn't. You know, these things can be oversold. But, you know, even in the town I live in Cambridge, it's weird how much local politics can be turned on a, you know, turned on its head by Tories campaigning against the congestion charge. And then Tories start winning safe Labour wards on the local council. And I think they look at what happened in the Netherlands with Geert Wilders. Mm-hmm. I think they look at some of what's happening in places like Germany, and they see a rising tide of popular anti-green resistance. And that part of the message, I think, is quite well coordinated. I think that's where, I'm pretty sure that's where Nigel Farage is putting his money at the moment. It fits with a massive agenda in the United States, you know, the Koch brothers and the use of huge amounts of lobbying money to push back against the regulatory state on the grounds that it's stifling American business, which is a, you know, large parts of it is anti-climate politics. And I think there they have a feeling that there will be a point in the next 5 years or maybe 10 years, say there's going to be 10 years of a Labour government. At some point in those 10 years, there will be an economic crisis, you know, things will fall apart, there will be an international crisis. And the well-funded, coordinated organization in British politics that is willing to stand up for people who've had enough of being told what to do by these elites who are pushing down their throats what they see as a sort of green agenda, I think they think that's a winner. And that's the thing where I think they might not be wrong.
Yeah, I'm scared about that.
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think it is scary, and it's happening in Europe. I think one of the mistakes that people make is they assume this is primarily anti-immigrant politics. So clearly it is in part. So there's a lot here about, you know, the ways in which the courts are not standing up for what people have voted for, which is, you know, to keep immigrants out and so on. And no question, some of the politics of the right, the far right in Europe is still primarily anti-immigrant. But I think people have missed the extent to which that has been overlaid by, and in some cases supplanted by, anti-green politics. Yeah. It's in the same space and it uses some of the same rhetoric. It's about these quangos and these courts and civil servants who are kind of woke and lefty and are pushing this agenda down people's throats. But I think they've spotted that you can actually go further with the green one in some respects than the anti-immigrant one, because green policies, when they impact on people, when they pinch on people, really annoy them, you know, day to day, really annoy them. And that's the nexus that they're trying to exploit. And, you know, when you think about it in more apocalyptic terms, you know, I can sort of think of a future where you've got this sort of, you know, these two timeframes, one of which is climate change is real, it's happening, and bad stuff is going to happen, and people are going to notice, and they're going to want their governments to do something about it. And so skillful governments, including progressive governments, should be well placed to use the climate crisis to do things that will be popular, which will try and tackle the climate crisis. And at the same time, over the next 10, 15 years, politics is going to be extremely volatile and testy, and there will be crises coming from all sorts of different directions. And progressive governments in power may find themselves incredibly vulnerable to a kind of populist, anti-bureaucratic, anti-climate, anti-immigrant movement. And these two timeframes are happening at the same time. You know, I don't know which one's going to win. So in that sense, it's not about the biscuits. The stakes couldn't be higher.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And I think the American radical right have proven very effective at both downstream thinking and segmented political messaging. If you look at the way in which Bannon and Trump in this campaign are really targeting the male misogynist voter of all different ethnicities, really seeing that as a way to sort of reach out to this kind of cultural backlash sentiment against the elites. It kind of is new and is quite innovative, if you like, in their thinking. It demonstrates a kind of sophistication that you don't have, I think, in some European radical right circles in quite the same way. Where I feel that the follow the money aspect does have, you know, some purchase is that basically on the crude metric that you only need 0.00005 5%, I hope listeners don't check my maths, of the money circulating in American politics to have massive, qualitatively bigger impact in European politics and including British politics. I was chatting to an American friend recently, and I mused, I don't know whether this will be correct, but I thought at the next general election, maybe the combined campaign spending of the two different parties might hit £100 million, $120 million perhaps. Maybe it'll be a bit more, maybe it'll be a bit less, I don't know. And he laughed and said, well, in a US Senate primary race, you could easily blow among candidates $120 million, easily, if it was a contested race. So just the scale of the campaign financing in the US is on a different stratosphere. So the bang for the buck that the American kind of far-right financing ecosystem can get for their money over here is just going to be much bigger. And how does that link in then, David, to this question of how the progressive response deals with a potential wave like that, thinking both in the conjuncture and further downstream? What's a skint progressive meant to do facing that kind of power and resources?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I was thinking about this, that pitch of the popcorns is that they are this little plucky band of upstarts fighting against this vast infrastructure that is biased against them. So the left, they think, has taken control of more or less everything. The universities, the BBC, the civil service, the courts, the entire legal system. You know, so they think, doesn't matter how much money they have, they're this tiny, they think they're a drop in the ocean in the face of this sort of wave of institutional forces that are arrayed against them. And then people on the left or progressive side have a mirror image view, which is, you know, they are skint and they are the sort of plucky upstarts. You know, they're trying to assemble political movements almost out of nothing, and they're facing this wave of money and international influence and so on. Each side thinks that the other side is massively, you know, overgeared against them. And you know, I suppose it can't, both of these things can't both be true, but there is, you know, there is some truth in both of them. I mean, after all, there is some truth. Maybe they have the money, but the other side does still have many of the institutions. And it's, you know, quite a few of these institutions are, one would hope, like the law courts, even the civil service, I'm not so sure about that, are relatively impervious to the impact of this kind of money. You know, I don't know what progressive politicians or people who support progressive causes should do, but I think it is worth at least thinking about, you know, where are the strengths that aren't so vulnerable to this. But also, I think to plan seriously, and I'm not sure the Labour Party is doing this, to plan seriously about what the response will be when that moment comes that I was talking about, which is, say, a scenario for British politics in the next 5 years, Labour wins a big majority of the next election. The Conservative Party is reduced not to a rump, but to something quite small. And many of the MPs are on this more right populist wing of the party. I don't know who they elect as leader, say Kemi Badenoch or someone like that. There's a lot of this money there, but you know, the Labour Party has, it's in government, it has parliament on its side, it has many allies in all sorts of different institutions. What's the response going to be when the real crisis hits? You know, there will be a crisis in the first Labour government, a financial crisis, an international crisis, where the opposition will feel this is our moment now to unleash this agenda, which is, you know, these quangocrats, these bureaucrats, Keir Starmer is a North London lawyer, and he's forcing all this stuff down your throats, and now the people must resist. What is going to be the response? And I'm not sure I know or have heard a convincing answer as to what the response is going to be. But it is definitely something I think that in Britain, progressive politicians should be thinking really hard about. I mean, that's going to be the crunch point. I don't think the coming general election is the crunch point. It's a done deal. Liz Truss trashed the brand. The Conservatives are done, probably for 10 years. But at some point in those 10 years, the real crunch will come, which is this version of conservatism will see its opportunity to really take on what they think are this array of institutions. How are these institutions going to be prepared to fight back? I don't know, But I'm not sure people are thinking hard enough about that question. You can write these people off, or you can think that elections are what are decisive. That's just not true. What's going to be decisive in British politics is something that will happen between probably the coming election and the one after that. And even if the Conservative Party only have 160 MPs, and even if they're led not by Kemi Badenoch, but by Suella Braverman, if the Labour government falls apart under economic or other kinds of pressure, it could change overnight.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's certainly the question that's going on in the kind of soft left that's been excluded by Starmer's Labour operation, which is that if they fail, and they're not even talking in terms of like a financial crisis or an international crisis, just if Labour fails to improve the lot of people in one period or two terms of government, that they'll have kind of ushered in the far right. But I don't think anybody's thought hard enough about what that looks like. And I think it is likely to look like an anti-green, anti-environmental movement. Yeah.
I mean, I think it is. And then there's a lot you can do off the back of that. You know, that's the thing. I think part of the, maybe not the discipline of that version of right-wing politics, but part almost of its opportunistic qualities, because I think these people are opportunists. I mean, they're weird. They're a weird combination of, sort of, you know, they're quite Leninist in their way. You sort of feel that their politics is, it doesn't really matter what happens in elections, and it doesn't really matter that everyone hates us, and it doesn't really matter that we look ridiculous, because a moment will come and we'll be prepared and they won't be prepared. And the moment could be something really bad. And in some ways, I think the worse, the better, you know, something really kicks off, a war in Europe. It doesn't matter what it is. And these things are all possible in the next 5 to 10 years. You know, we're well placed to exploit that. And that's the frightening part of it. And I think we are entering a phase of politics which probably does suit the opportunists. And then off the back of whatever it is they exploit, you know, maybe we can exploit it through climate, maybe we can exploit it through, you know, people's irritation about cycle lanes. And off the back of that irritation about cycle lanes, we can bring in a really big and not well thought through, but seriously thought through agenda. And yeah, I just think, I don't know, I think the left hasn't really thought hard enough about its response. So I don't know whether the left needs to be more opportunistic. I don't know whether the left needs to be more Leninist, or whether actually the left should think about what its strengths are. And its strengths do include the fact that it still has a lot of these institutions, you know, on its side. I mean, the popcorns aren't wrong. They aren't wrong to think that many of these institutions don't contain many people like them. I mean, they're not full of communists. They're just not full of, you know, far-right Leninists. And so, you know, where are the real institutional strengths? You know, universities are in a complete mess at the moment. Universities are both incredibly strong institutions with real durability and real long-term strength, and they're just in a complete tangle about what it is they should be doing. I think it's probably even true within the civil service. You know, it's definitely true of the BBC. And I don't know what the answer is, but I do think there is a case for thinking about the worst case scenario and then thinking about what would be a plausible response under those conditions. You know, maybe the Starmer government will improve public services and will be quite popular and the crisis won't come. Great. But I still think it's worth thinking about the other thing.
I think that's exactly right. You know, there's this kind of rise of conservative Leninism, if you like, and the Labour Party are not thinking strategically around where their resource strengths are in society. You know, if you're serious about fixing British infrastructure, for instance, do you need to really look at public sector pay in the civil service to improve institutional capacity and really have a strategic goal to raise it up to the private sector over the course of 10 years to strengthen the ability of the British state to deliver sizable, sustainable, big infrastructure projects? Is that even a discussion happening in the Labour leadership? I don't think so, really. It will all be framed as a kind of series of conjunctural strategic conflicts with trade unions, where we look at inflation this year and we say, do we slightly go over it, or do we slightly, you know, squeeze the public sector pay to meet our fiscal commitments? It's just not really a discussion. And similarly, as you say, in universities, you know, they have this remarkable ability of turning out generations of graduates that have progressive goals and values and think very progressively, so strategically, as a, you know, someone that recognizes that there's this real danger downstream of far right Leninist politics, shouldn't you strengthen them? Shouldn't you build that institutional capacity? And you don't really feel that the current Labour leadership is even thinking in those terms. And I was just wondering, David, you know, is there a contrast here in that you mention in your Guardian article very, very briefly, you sort of in a throwaway remark, you might say, you do briefly compare Truss to Jeremy Corbyn, but there does seem to be a really big striking difference in that context between a kind of radicalization that's taking place within conservatism and the timidity of the contemporary Labour Party. That's just a backlash against the Corbyn era. Is there more that you would say about that? What do you think?
I mean, as you were speaking now, I was thinking actually one of the ways in which the Labour Party could be more Leninist is there would be a fear, I think. So what you described, say a Labour strategic vision could include, we've really got to improve pay in the public sector. And we've basically got to invest heavily, actually, in the institutions that we think are really important. And part of the fear would be, but that's falling into the trap of doing what they say we are, which is that we are people who basically, you know, pad the parts of the state that support us and so on. And the Labour Party is spooked by the thought that they might do things that fit with the criticism that comes of them from the popular conservative right. Whereas I think a more confident Labour Party would embrace that. And, you know, in the way that Lenin didn't care what his enemies thought of him. Indeed, the more that Lenin thought his enemies believed that he was a real danger, the better. You know, they're going to believe that anyway. They're going to, you know, they believe that the Bank of England is full of communists. So there's not much point in worrying about doing things that might allow them to say, told you so, because they're going to say, told you so anyway. So the alternative would be to actually embrace the critique and say, right, this is what the right think of us. So what we have to make sure is that when we do the things that they accuse us of doing, people can see it does make a difference to their lives. And that's going to be our argument. That's going to be the defense. But it is odd. And, you know, part of the tragedy of the politics of the left in the UK is that the Labour Party wins elections after it's lost 5 or 4 in a row, by which time it's so terrified of defeat that it's spooked by its own shadow. Whereas this seems like a moment when you look at what's coming in terms of an opposition on the right, and you can see it. So, one, this election result is pretty predictable. Labour are going to win. Two, what's going to happen to the Conservative Party is pretty predictable. It's going to move to the right, to the pop right. It's not going to be Liz Truss, but it'll be someone more competent than her. We know this is coming. So how do you prepare for it? You know, embrace that. Don't be spooked by it. Embrace it. And the things that you just described there, Luke, seem to me the kind of things that the Labour Party is frightened of, maybe partly because it's scarred by the Corbyn years, but also by the thought that they don't want to do things that their far-right opponents would say of those things. That's exactly what we're talking about. Well, no, they should do those things.
I'm feeling quite cheerful now because I feel like you've done a plausible to-do list for people on the progressive left, and you never hear those. Why there is a sense of pre-defeatism in, certainly in France, they're kind of assuming it's a Le Pen win, and beyond, the Social Democrats seem to have kind of given up and gone home in advance. Do you think that's true, firstly? And secondly, what can they do about that?
Yeah, I mean, I do think in this, it's a slightly boring thing to say, but electoral systems do make a huge difference. You know, why is Britain an outlier? And indeed, you know, I don't know who's going to win, but say Biden wins, you know, Biden might well win. So the United States and Britain might be outliers. It's partly because first past the post systems do help hold the left together. And if Keir Starmer becomes prime minister, it's because actually people have had enough of the Tories and there's nowhere else to go but Labour. So you also get a slightly artificial inflation of, I mean, I don't think Labour are that popular at the moment in the UK, but they may will, you know, an absolutely massive majority. I don't know. And there is something artificial about voting systems, just as in France. You know, the reason that Marine Le Pen has never actually won is because the presidential system in the end forces a binary, a two-way choice. And it's harder to win from the far right in those ways, in the way that in Italy, Meloni, you know, is able to win because systems that divide the vote up can allow the party of the far right to come top in an election. So I think a lot of the collapse of the progressive left has something to do with different electoral systems. It seems to be worse under various kinds of proportional systems. I think it's in France, it's very hard to see how a center-left candidate is going to be one of the two that makes it to the final round of the presidential election. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I think Marine Le Pen might actually win because Macron, you know, isn't going to run again. And I don't know. And the Mélenchon-Corbyn left does have a ceiling. I mean, there's no question. I think that form of politics does have a ceiling. So in a two-party system, it's very hard for that form of politics to win. But I mean, the defeatism seems odd because if anything is true about the next period of politics, it's going to be volatile. I mean, and that's the other thing. So the right embraces that volatility. It's weird because they're meant to be conservative, some of them. They're meant to believe in continuity, but actually they seem to embrace the idea that actually anything could happen. And they do take some inspiration here from Trump. You know, Trump became president of the United States. So anything is possible in this world. Anything is possible. And the left doesn't seem to be so happy embracing the thought that, you know, weird stuff might happen. But maybe that's also where the hope should come from. Things are moving in different directions. There's not a single direction of travel here. It's not like the populist right is going to sweep Europe. You know, in Poland, it's moving a different way. In Brazil, it seems to have moved a different way. I wouldn't give up on the United States yet at all. The Keir Starmer government might be a roaring success. You know, all sorts of different things could happen. Bare reality of electoral systems does create barriers to certain kinds of change. But I don't think defeatism, I mean, the idea that thinking about the next 10 years of politics, the rational thing to do is to be fatalistic and defeatist seems insane. Because, you know, fatalism implies there's a direction of travel and there's nothing anyone can do to shift it. And if anything, the last 10 years of politics has told us that's just not true. It's just not true.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this isn't a criticism of your remarks on today's podcast, David, at all, because we did indeed invite you on to talk about the authoritarian right. So that's what we've talked about. But on the European elections, I think in particular, there is always this tendency in both the media, but also reverberates through progressive spaces to what Zoe referred to as the sense of pre-defeat. I mean, sure, the far right are going to make gains in the European elections, but so are actually the far left, according to the opinion polls. Social democracy about sitting where it is, a few losses. You know, these are not dramatic shifts in the political coloration of the European Parliament. And in any case, they just posit the same question that we were familiar with previously, i.e. whether the centre-right chooses to govern with the far-right in the European Parliament or whether it continues to govern with the Liberals and centre-left to create that democratic majority, if you like. So I think after the European elections, there will be a dramatic sort of media and progressive reaction. I mean, we were talking about doing an event about Another Europe Is Possible, where we talk about the election results, and a number of us were saying, God, we really shouldn't say, what do we do about the authoritarian right breakthrough? Because, you know, we would and frame the whole discussion in those terms, because I think we would be reinforcing that sense of fatalism.
I agree with both of you. I think the pre-defeatism is a mistake.
I think pre-defeatism is probably always a mistake. I mean, there are probably some circumstances where it's the right thing to do, but I don't think these are those circumstances.